From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. I know many people feel like we are entering a dark time, but for the benefit of us all, I hope that is not the case.
As Kamala Harris concedes to Donald Trump, we'll look at the roots of Trump's victory. Bernie Sanders blames the Democrats for abandoning the working class. We'll speak to UCLA professor Robin D.G. Kelly, as well as journalist Fatima Bhutto. We'll talk about the global implications of Trump's return to the White House. Plus, we'll look at Trump's vow to deport millions of immigrants.
As soon as I take the oath of office, I'll terminate every open border policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
And we'll speak with Professor Anura Kalminyan, author of In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Kamala Harris has conceded the 2024 presidential race to Donald Trump, promising a peaceful transfer of power. Harris addressed supporters Wednesday afternoon at her alma mater, Howard University, after calling Trump to congratulate him.
In our nation, we owe loyalty not to a president or a party, but to the Constitution of the United States. And loyalty to our conscience and to our God. My allegiance to all three is why I am here to say, while I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign. This is not a time to throw up our hands. This is a time to roll up our sleeves.
With millions of ballots still to be counted, Trump is expected to match the 74 million votes he received in 2020. Kamala Harris, meanwhile, won just 68 million votes so far, lagging far behind Joe Biden's performance in 2020 when he got 81 million votes. The vast majority of the 3,000-plus counties across the United States, whether urban, suburban or rural, swung right in this year's election. Control over the House of Representatives remains up for grabs, with dozens of races yet to be called. So far, Republicans have claimed 206 House seats compared to Democrats' 191. Whichever party reaches 218 will hold the majority and can determine who becomes House Speaker. Meanwhile, Republicans have increased their control over the Senate after winning a majority of seats for the first time since 2020. In Montana, incumbent Democratic Senator John Tester has lost his reelection bid, flipping another Senate seat for Republicans. He was defeated by Tim Sheehy, a former Navy SEAL endorsed by Donald Trump. Sheehy gets an A rating from the National Rifle Association, is strongly anti-abortion. Earlier this year, Montana's Charcuta News published audio clips of Sheehy at campaign events making racist and highly offensive comments about Native Americans. In Nevada, Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen will hold on to her seat after fending off a challenge from Republican Sam Brown. Rosen's a former synagogue president, first elected to the Senate in 2018. In Michigan, Democratic Congressmember Alyssa Slotkin has narrowly won an open U.S. Senate seat, defeating Republican Mike Rogers. Slotkin's a former Middle East analyst for the CIA who served three terms in Iraq under George W. Bush. She also worked as a high-ranking Pentagon official under President Obama. Puerto Rico's non-voting member of Congress, Republican Jennifer Gonzalez, is set to become the island's next governor. She's a supporter of statehood for Puerto Rico and a Trump supporter. She's on track to narrowly beat Juan Dalmau of the Alianza Coalition. The center-left third party group made history gains in this year's election, with Puerto Rican voters disaffected with the two main parties. The world's richest person, Elon Musk, saw his net worth soar by over $16 billion Wednesday after Donald Trump secured victory. His net worth is now estimated at $290 billion. Musk personally spent about $120 million helping Trump get elected and used his social media site X, formerly Twitter, to promote Trump's campaign. On Tuesday, Musk wrote, quote, "Men are voting in record numbers. They now realize everything is at stake." Musk was echoing Republican talking points aimed at countering Kamala Harris's support among women and voter dissatisfaction with abortion bans. Trump vowed to install Musk as head of a new government efficiency commission. Musk has proposed cuts of at least $2 trillion to federal spending. Meanwhile, CNN and Politico are reporting Trump has tapped Brian Hook, a top State Department official during the first Trump administration, to begin staffing the State Department. Hook served as special envoy for Iran under Trump, leading the maximum pressure campaign of sanctions, sabotage, and assassinations against Tehran. Special Counsel Jack Smith is reportedly preparing to wind down his two federal criminal cases against Donald Trump in line with Justice Department policy that shields a sitting president from prosecution. Smith charged Trump with election subversion and illegally retaining classified documents. During campaigning, Trump said he would fire Smith within 2 seconds if he was reelected. Meanwhile, Trump's lawyers are expected to ask New York Judge Juan Merchan to delay sentencing in Trump's New York hush money and election interference trial. Trump's sentencing on 34 felony counts was postponed earlier this year to November 26th. Georgia's sweeping election subversion case against Trump is also at risk of being delayed due to his reelection. Immigrant communities across the U.S. and asylum seekers near the U.S. border are trying to figure out what an incoming Trump administration will mean for their safety and their rights. This is immigrant rights activist Jose Garcia, who works with asylum seekers in Tijuana.
For us, the concerns here in the north is that the migrant communities will be stuck. However, we will also see many migrants wanting to cross irregularly based on the fact that these aid programs are going to be removed. People will risk more to want to cross irregularly at the various points in our border areas. It is a latent risk where they can be robbed, assaulted, where they can be abandoned to their fate, and in a moment, they can even lose their lives.
We'll have more on immigration later in the broadcast with Stanford professor Ana Raquel Minyan. The Israeli military says Palestinians from northern Gaza will not be allowed to return to their homes, effectively admitting to ethnically cleansing the region. A military official said any future aid to Gaza would only be allowed to enter through the south, but not the north, where there are, quote, no more civilians left, unquote. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Wateridge posted a harrowing video from northern Gaza showing its utter decimation. Wateridge wrote, quote, "No matter from what direction you enter, homes, hospitals, schools, health clinics, mosques, apartments, restaurants, all completely flattened. An entire society, now a graveyard," unquote. This comes as the head of UNRWA warned once again the agency will collapse, quote, without intervention by member states. Reuters reports the UN suggested in a letter to Israel that replacing the aid provided by UNRWA would become Israel's responsibility after it recently cut ties with the UN agency. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization resumed large-scale medical evacuations Wednesday, moving over 100 critical patients out of Gaza. Fewer than 300 patients had been able to leave Gaza since Israel blocked the Rafah crossing in May. The WHO estimates up to 14,000 Palestinians are in need of urgent medical evacuation from Gaza. Israeli attacks on Gaza have killed at least 27 Palestinians since the day started, including at least 3 children in Rafah. In Lebanon, residents of Beirut woke up to smoke-filled skies this morning after a night of Israeli bombardment targeting the capital's southern neighborhoods. This followed deadly Israeli strikes on the eastern Bekaa Valley and the city of Baalbek, which killed at least 40 people and wounded 50 on Wednesday. Hezbollah said it launched a series of attack drones at the Bilu military base south of Tel Aviv in response to the latest attacks. Lebanese residents of Beirut continue to condemn Israel's escalating assault on Lebanon.
This is a savage, predatory enemy that destroys homes, kills people, and kills civilization. It cannot defeat the Hezbollah party. It cannot defeat them with destroying civilizations, with destroying homes, with anything. It cannot defeat them. And I say to Hezbollah, do not stop. Do not stop resisting this enemy. I mean, what is taken away by force must return by force, too.
Meanwhile, Lebanon has filed a complaint at the UN's International Labor Organization over Israel's September terror attack in which 4,000 people were killed or wounded when their pagers suddenly exploded across Lebanon. Russia ratified a mutual defense pact with North Korea Wednesday, solidifying the military alliance between Moscow and Pyongyang. This comes as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned of a, quote, new chapter of instability after revealing his troops fought North Korean soldiers on the battlefield for the first time. The combat reportedly took place earlier this week in Russia's Kursk region, though South Korea downplayed the encounter, labeling it an incident involving a small number of fighters. Ukraine says some 11,000 North Korean soldiers are now stationed in Kursk, where Ukraine launched a surprise counterinvasion in August. Germany's governing coalition collapsed Wednesday after Chancellor Olaf Scholz fired his finance minister following failed talks between the three ruling parties. Scholz said he'll remain in office, but called for a confidence vote January 15th, which could lead to fresh elections by the end of March.
I will now very quickly seek a conversation with the opposition leader, Friedrich Merz. I would like to offer him to work constructively together on two issues, or more, which are important for our country, the quick strengthening of our economy and our defense. Our economy can't wait until a snap election takes place.
The Pakistani province of Punjab is asking people to stay home as much as possible, halting in-person schooling and setting up a so-called smog war room in an effort to tackle record levels of air pollution that have choked the region. Hospitals report a spike in patients with respiratory and other smog-related conditions. The air quality index in Lahore recently soared as high as 120 times over recommended levels.
I'm struggling with shortness of breath and watery eyes, likely from poor air quality. I'll stay home until it's safe to venture out.
Government officials say they're investigating ways to mitigate the pollution, including inducing artificial rainfall. This suffocating smog is brought about by a combination of crop burning, vehicular and industrial emissions, and colder air. In Southern California, 14,000 people in Ventura County have been told to evacuate as firefighters battle the fast-moving mountain fire. Nearby, another wildfire, the Broad Fire in Malibu, also erupted Wednesday amidst the dry conditions and strong winds. Forecasters say the rest of the week could bring extremely critical wildfire danger to the region. And Cuba's power grid collapsed again on Wednesday as Hurricane Rafael lashed the island nation with torrential rains and sustained winds of 115 miles per hour. The decades-long U.S.-led embargo on Cuba has left Cuba unable to update its ailing energy infrastructure or import enough fuel and food for its residents. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Kamala Harris has conceded to Donald Trump after the former president pulled off an overwhelming victory Tuesday to send him back to the White House. On Wednesday, Harris spoke at Howard University.
I will never give up the fight for a future where Americans can pursue their dreams, ambitions, and aspirations, where the women of America have the freedom to make decisions about their own body and not have their government telling them what to do. We will never give up the fight to protect our schools and our streets from gun violence. And America, we will never give up the fight for our democracy, for the rule of law, for equal justice, and for the sacred idea that every one of us, no matter who we are or where we start out, has certain fundamental rights and freedoms that must be respected and upheld.
That was Kamala Harris giving her concession speech on Wednesday. The Democratic Party is in a state of crisis after Trump expanded his support across the country and Republicans also regained control of the Senate. Republicans may also keep control of the House.
On Wednesday, independent Senator Bernie Sanders blasted the Democratic Party. In a statement, Sanders said, quote, "It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party, which has abandoned working class people, would find that the working class has abandoned them. While the Democratic leadership defends the status quo, the American people are angry and want change. And they're right," Sanders said. To talk more about Tuesday's election, we're joined by Robin D.G. Kelley, professor of history at UCLA, who studies social movements. He's author of many books, including Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. Professor Kelley, it's great to have you back with us. If you can start off by talking about Donald Trump's major victory, I mean, sweeping the country, actually winning the popular vote as well as what looks like the Electoral College vote, Harris winning far fewer millions of votes than President Biden did in 2020, though some Democrats, for example, Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan, polled much higher and won. She did not get those same votes. And end by talking about what Democratic Senator Sanders is saying, that the Democratic Party has abandoned the working class.
Right. Let's begin with Senator Sanders. He's absolutely right. The Democratic Party abandoned the working class. Kamala Harris ran on a ticket of moving toward the right, you know, shifting, you know, pivoting toward the right, bragging that Liz Cheney is endorsing her. And so there was really no program to focus on the actual suffering of working people across the board. That's true. Now, when we think about 2024 compared to 2020, I'm not sure that Trump's victory is so historic. Trump would have won in 2020 had it not been for the uprisings and that emerged out of the George Floyd murder. The win was behind the Democratic Party, even though the Democratic Party didn't earn that win. And so I think that's a factor. The other factor is that the country is moving toward the right, and the working class, working classes, feel really disaffected and abandoned. They feel abandoned, I believe, for a couple of reasons. One, because whatever the numbers said about the shifting in economy, the fact of the matter is that people are still dealing with inflation, with joblessness, with insecurity. But the second thing, and this goes back to an article I published back in 2016, we also have, a deeply racist, Islamophobic, xenophobic nation. And that runs through. I mean, when you look at the demographics, white men consistently vote for Trump. White women, of course, there was a slight shift, but the shift wasn't that radical. I mean, I don't trust exit polls, but it's amazing how many white women supported Trump. It's amazing how much of the message of fascism actually did tap into a deep insecurity, a deep fear, and the fact that deportation is the dominant message that is drawing working people. So I really want to talk about the question of class, which I think is most important. We have a class that's suffering, but we don't have a class that thinks of itself as a class. If we had a class that thought of itself as a class, then working people would say, we refuse deportation, we refuse racism, we refuse transphobia, because that's what the class does. Solidarity is what's missing, the sense that we as a class, you know, have to protect each other. Trump is seen as the person who can fix things, the person who represents the CEO who could step in and solve problems in a culture in which the only solidarity we're seeing, the primary solidarity, is coming from the capitalist class, you know? So I'm not sure that there's such a radical shift from 2016 to 2020 to 2024. It's a failure of the Democratic Party. And even under Biden, the Democratic Party actually pivoted a little bit toward labor in a way that the Harris campaign did not.
Well, I'd like to go to former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner, who we spoke to last week. She served as co-chair of Independent Senator Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign.
I think over time, the Democratic Party lost its way in terms of just talking to working class voters. And I mean from all identities, because sometimes when we say working class, people assume we're just talking about white men. I'm talking about working class people from all walks of life. And my state, you know, CAFTA, NAFTA, this happened over time. It didn't just happen in one fell swoop. It happened over decade after decade after decade. But those trade deals definitely decimated Midwestern states like mine and really hurt a lot of workers. And then working class people from all backgrounds do not necessarily see themselves. They feel like elitism has taken over for both parties, but especially in the Democratic Party. And so when you don't see yourself in a party, you decide that you want to go another way. And then more recently, when I say recently, certainly over the almost 4 years, as people were suffering the effects of COVID, we're all trying to break out of it, inflation very high, the cost of groceries high, the cost of gas high, all of those material condition elements, the Democratic Party denied that, and they trotted out Bidenomics, and they turned their backs on people and made it seem as though the pain points that the big mamas and big papas were feeling were not necessarily real. You cannot do that.
So, Robin Kelly, that was Ohio State Senator Nina Turner. If you could respond to what she said and put it in the context of what you mentioned earlier, namely the absence of working class cohesion and what that meant for this election. And why, in fact, why do you think there is an absence of cohesion among the working class in the U.S.?
Right. No, I think I totally agree with what Nina Turner said. This is where we are right now. The absence of cohesion has to do with the general two things, I think. One, the general absence of solidarity in a longstanding kind of neoliberal culture where people are taught to solve their own problems, a kind of deep individualism, and that corporate interests are the only ones, in other words, private interests are the ones that could solve your problem. Government is a problem. Government gets in the way. This is the kind of discourse that we've been seeing for at least 3-4 decades. And so even though we see amazing developments in the labor movement with the UAW, we see discussions and talk of solidarity, the Boeing strike, for example. But in terms of those who are either unorganized or at the sort of edges of a concierge economy that is no longer based in high-wage manufacturing, what ends up happening is almost impossible to organize people and to think as a class. And, you know, the Amazon strike in Bessemer is a really good example of what could have been, but how the combination of fear, insecurity, and the failure to really think of solidarity, in other words, to care for our neighbor, to care for those who are not us, but maybe we share the same class, that sense of solidarity that Audre Lorde talks about at the beginning of my piece, that's missing. And we haven't done the work, the political education work, to build that sense of cohesion. But the other thing that I think is really important is this belief that that we could one day become Trump. In other words, wealth, entrepreneurship, this striving for success, the fact that a lot of these Senate campaigns, these you know, where seats were overturned, they were won by billionaires and millionaires. You know, I mean, that's significant. And one other thing I should add is that, you know, we could look at this at the presidential level. We could also look at the local level. I'm here in L.A. In what's supposed to be the left coast, California, where we just had propositions that failed, a proposition to end prison, forced prison labor, a proposition to raise the minimum wage, a proposition for rent control, you know, a proposition that actually, the one proposition that did win was one that was deeply criminalized and extend sentences for petty crimes. This is in L.A. You see, this is California. So we're moving toward the right, and somehow the right, for many people, is attractive. And we have to figure out why it's attractive. And if we don't think of ourselves as a class with power, a class in which the state could be the lever of equality rather than deep inequality, then we're going to be stuck supporting Trumps for the rest, for generations.
Yeah, it's very interesting on the issue of prison labor and the ballot initiative there. When we were out in California interviewing prisoner firefighters who got a pittance a day, they were pushing for earlier release, but they didn't get it often because it provided a prisoner labor force for the wildfires that plague California. But I wanted to ask you about the extremism of Trump when he was talking about, or, you know, at the Madison Square Garden rally, of course, that Puerto Rico is an island of garbage. He would later call that whole rally a love fest, you know, referring to women as the B word, and, of course, how he deals with immigrants. But there's a very interesting comment of writer Meg Indurti, who tweeted, "If you're someone who is able to overlook the genocide and cast a vote for Kamala Harris, then you already understand how a conservative was able to overlook Trump's extremism to vote for him." Can you comment on this? Robin Kelly, you talk a lot about the working class and the working poor. You also have written extensively about Gaza.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, one of the questions that came up, my students were posing this question to me the other day. What would have happened had the U.S. actually stopped supporting Israel, like in November or December of last year? What would have happened? I think the Democrats could have won. You know, we overestimate the power of the Israeli lobby, and because in some ways Democrats are looking for dollars, not necessarily votes. And so imagine what would have happened had there been this refusal to send arms to Israel. There would be no—the war would have ended. There wouldn't be an escalation of the war. And part of the attraction of Trump, ironically, is this belief, it's kind of a myth, but still, this belief that under Trump there were no wars, you know? And so here we have possibly three different wars going on at once under the Democrats, and you could see how that would generate some fear. But to go back to the question of the extremism and elites, you know, toxic masculinity is a huge factor. The buildup coming from state right-wing state legislatures to attack the curriculum, to attack DEI, to attack, you know, trans people at every single level. Here we are dealing with an extremism that is actually palpable, and that I could see how some elites on the right, those who actually have drafted Project 2025, would support these policies. So in some ways, what we keep calling fascism, which I agree is fascism, is pretty mainstream among the Project 2025 people, pretty mainstream among the MAGA Republicans. And the Republican Party is a MAGA party. Whatever the old bourgeoisie of the kind of older neoliberal order, whatever they think, they're either going to go with the program or they're going to do what they did, support Harris and Waltz, and that didn't work out for them. So, I mean, I'm actually terrified by a future in which the kind of violence of the settler colonial mentality, which was always there, has escalated and become normalized in a way. And let's remember that the history of fascism is filled with supporters who themselves are targets of fascism. We have examples of that, you know, historically. So, you know, it's hard. So we can't just assume it because there's an uptick in, say, the Latino vote in support for Trump, that somehow that's an example of Trumpism's multiculturalism. It's still white supremacy and patriarchy.
So, Robin Kelly, I just want to go back for a second to the point that you made earlier about those ballot measures. Why do you think those ballot measures were rejected? How did they get on the ballot to begin with? And then is that related at all to the fact that, you know, the Democrats have come under massive criticism for after 2016, after the Clinton election, basically finding ways to blame everybody but themselves? Is there a risk that that's going to happen again?
Yes, I think there's a risk. As far as the propositions, you know, California is a conservative state. You know, it has been. It has produced some of the most conservative governors. It is the home of the origins of the John Birch Society. You know, this is a conservative state. So it didn't surprise me too much, although California is also a state that has, you know, had basically the biggest for a long time, or at least second largest prison population in the country. And so some of these initiatives came from imprisoned people themselves, came from abolitionists. The struggle for a minimum wage came from an organized labor movement. But there's still deep anti-immigrant sentiment here in California, deep anti-labor sentiment. And keep in mind that rent control has been consistently beat down since 1995. And why? Because some of the same elites who gave money to the Harris campaign are also absentee or, you know, venture capitalists who own a lot of property, and they're trying to profit off of them. The Democrats, I don't have an answer to that except for the fact that we can't keep relying on the Democratic Party. I mean, it's so bankrupt. I think what Ralph Nader said yesterday is absolutely true. We need something else, you know, if not a real third party. I think Reverend William Barber has an answer, and that is to build from the bottom up, to build from low-wage workers, because that's the vast majority of the people. But we can't do this until we actually think of ourselves as a community, that a beloved community as a class that struggles with each other against corporate interests.
And we will be speaking with Reverend Barber tomorrow, so people should tune in. And Ralph Nader's comments on Democracy Now! Just exploded yesterday, so people can check them out at democracynow.org. Robin D.G. Kelly, thank you so much for being with us, professor of history at UCLA, who studies social movements, author of many books, including Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. Coming up, we go to speak with Fatima Bhutto on what Trump's election means for the world. Brilliant Corners by Thelonious Monk, who was the subject of an acclaimed book by our last guest, Robin D.G. Kelley. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
As we continue to look at Donald Trump's return to the White House, we turn now to look at what it means for the world, from Israel's war on Gaza to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. During his victory speech, Trump vowed that he was going to, quote, stop wars. But what will Trump's foreign policy actually look like?
We're joined now by Fatima Bhutto, award-winning author of several works of fiction and nonfiction, including The Runaways, New Kings of the World. She is co-editing a book, along with Sonia Falero, titled Gaza, The Story of a Genocide, due out next year. She writes a monthly column for Zatteo. Start off by just responding to Trump's runaway victory across the United States, Fatima.
Well, Amy, I don't think it's an aberration that he won. I think it's an aberration that he lost in 2020. And I think anyone looking at the American elections for the last year, even longer, could see very clearly that the Democrats were speaking to, I'm not sure who, to a hall of mirrors. They ran an incredibly weak and actually macabre campaign. To see Kamala Harris describe her politics as one of joy, as she promised the most lethal military in the world, talking about women's rights in America, essentially focusing those rights on the right to termination, while the rest of the world has watched women slaughtered in Gaza for 13 months straight. You know, it's very curious to think that they thought a winning strategy was Beyonce and that Taylor Swift was somehow a political winning strategy that was going to defeat who? Trump, who was speaking to people, who was speaking against wars. You know, whether we believe him or not, it was a marked difference from what Kamala Harris was saying and was not saying.
And Fatima, you wrote a piece for Zatteo earlier this year, titled, Gaza Has Exposed the Shameful Hypocrisy of Western Feminism. So you just mentioned the irony of Kamala Harris as, you know, the second presidential candidate, who's a woman, where so much of the campaign was about women, and the fact that, you know, of what's been unfolding on women, against women and children in Gaza for the last year, if you could elaborate.
We've seen, Nermeen, over the last year, you know, 70% of those slaughtered in Gaza by Israel, and let's also be clear, by America, because it's American bombs and American diplomatic cover that allows this slaughter to continue unabated. 70% of those victims are women and children. We have watched children with their heads blown off. We have watched children with no surviving family members find themselves in hospital with limbs missing. Gaza has the largest cohort of child amputees in the world. And we have seen newborns left to die as Israel switches off electricity and fuel of hospitals. So for Kamala Harris to come out and talk repeatedly about abortion, and I say this as someone who is pro-choice, who has always been pro-choice, was not just macabre, but it's obscene. It's an absolute betrayal of feminism, because feminism is about liberation. It's not about termination. And it's about protecting women at their most vulnerable and at their most frightened. And there was no sign of that. You know, we also saw Kamala Harris bring out celebrities. I mean, the utter vacuousness of bringing out Jennifer Lopez, Beyonce, and others to talk about being a mother, while mothers are being widowed, are being orphaned in Gaza. It was not just tone deaf. It seemed to have a certain hostility, a certain contempt for the suffering that the rest of us have been watching. I'd also like to add, to Robin's point about toxic masculinity, there was so much toxicity in Kamala Harris's campaign. You know, I watched her laugh with Oprah as she spoke about shooting someone who might enter her house with a gun, and giggling and saying her PR team may not like that, but she would kill them. You don't need to be a man to practice toxic masculinity, and you don't need to be white to practice white supremacy, as we've seen very clearly from this election cycle.
And yet, Fatima Bhutto, if you look at what Trump represented, and certainly the Muslim American community, the Arab American community, Jewish progressives, young people, African Americans, certainly understood what his Trump's policy was when he was president. And it's rare, you know, president comes back to serve again after a term away. It's only happened once before in history. But you have, for example, Trump moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. You have an illegal settlement named after Trump in the West Bank. The whole question of Netanyahu and his right-wing allies in Israel pushing for annexation of the West Bank, where Trump would stand on this. And of course, you have the Abraham Accords, which many Palestinians felt left them out completely. If you can talk about this, these were put forward by Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who, when the massive Gaza destruction was at its height, talked about Gaza as waterfront real estate.
Absolutely. There's no question that, Trump has been a malign force, not just when it concerns Palestinians, but frankly, out in the world. But I would argue there's not very much difference between what these two administrations or parties do. The difference is that Trump doesn't have the gloss and the charisma of an Obama or, I mean, I can't even say that Biden has charisma, but certainly the gloss. Trump says it. They do it. The difference I can't really tell the difference anymore. We saw the Biden administration send over 500 shipments of arms to Israel, betraying America's own laws, the fact that they are not allowed to export weapons of war to a country committing gross violations of human rights. We saw Bill Clinton trotted out in Michigan to tell Muslims that actually they should stop killing Israelis and that Jews were there before them. I mean, it was an utterly contemptuous speech. So What is the difference exactly? You know, we saw Bernie Sanders, who was mentioned earlier, write an op-ed in The Guardian in the days before the election, warning people that if they were not to vote for Kamala Harris, if Donald Trump was to get in, think about the climate crisis. Well, we've watched Israel's emissions in the first 5 months of their deadly attack on Gaza release more planet-warming gases into the atmosphere than 20 of the world's most climate-vulnerable nations released in a year. So I don't quite see that there is a difference between what Democrats allow and what Trump brags about. I think it's just a question of crudeness and decorum and politeness. One has it and one doesn't. In a sense, Trump is much clearer for the rest of the world because he says what he's going to do. And, you know, you take him at his word, whereas we have been gaslit and lied to by Anthony Blinken on a daily basis now since October 7th. Every time that AOC or Kamala Harris spoke about fighting desperately for a ceasefire, we saw more carnage, more massacres, and Israel committing crimes with total impunity. You know, it wasn't under Trump that Israel has killed more journalists than have ever been killed in any recorded conflict. It's under Biden that Israel has killed more UN workers than have ever been killed in the UN's history. So I'm not sure there's a difference. And, you know, we'll have to wait to see in the months ahead. But I don't think anyone is bracing for an upturn. Certainly people didn't vote for Kamala Harris. I'm not sure they voted for Trump. We know that she lost 14 million votes from Biden's win in 2020. And we know that those votes just didn't come out for the Democrats. Some may have migrated to Trump. Some may have gone to third parties. But 14 million just didn't go anywhere.
So, Fatima, if you could, you know, tell us what do you think the reasons are for that? I mean, the kind of, as you said, because it is really horrifying what has unfolded in Gaza in the last 13 months. You've written about this. You now have an edited anthology that you're editing, co-editing. You know, what do you think accounts for this, the sheer disregard for the lives of tens of thousands of Palestinians who've been killed in Gaza?
It's a total racism on the part, not just of America, but I'm speaking of the West here. This has been betrayed over the last year. The fact that Ukraine is spoken about with an admiration, you know, Zelensky is spoken about with a sort of hero worship, Ukrainian resistors to Russia's invasion are valorized. You know, Nancy Pelosi wore a bracelet of bullets used by the Ukrainian resistance against Trump. But Palestinians are painted as terrorists, are dehumanized to such an extent. You know, we saw that dehumanization from the mouths of Bill Clinton, no less, from the mouths of Kamala Harris, who interrupted somebody speaking out against the genocide and saying, I'm speaking. You know, what is more toxically masculine than that? We've also seen a concerted crackdown in universities across the United States on college students. I'm speaking also here of my own alma mater of Columbia University, of Barnard College, that called the NYPD, who fired live ammunition at their students. You know, this didn't happen. This extreme response didn't happen in protests against apartheid. It didn't happen in protests against Vietnam in quite the same way. And all I can think is America and the West, who have been fighting Muslim countries for the last 25, 30 years, see it as acceptable to do so. Our deaths are acceptable to them, and genocide is not a red line. And, you know, to go back to what Robin mentioned earlier about the working class that is absolutely ignored in America, and I would make the argument across the West, too, they have watched administration after, you know, president and congressman give billions and billions of dollars to Ukraine while they have no relief at home. They have no relief from debt. They have no relief from student debt. They have no medical care, no coverage. They're struggling to survive. And this is across the board. And after Ukraine, they saw billions go to Israel in the same way while they get, frankly, nothing.
Fatima Bhutto, we want to thank you so much for being with us, award-winning author of a number of works of fiction and nonfiction, including The Runaways and New Kings of the World, co-editing a book called Gaza, The Story of a Genocide, due out next year, writes a monthly column for Zatteo. Coming up, we look at Trump's vow to deport as many as 20 million immigrants. And J.D. Vance saying, yes, U.S. children born of immigrant parents could also be deported. Stay with us.
Si voy a regresar y por eso yo canto y aprieto mi santo cuando me siento a llorar.
Caravana by Las Cafeteras. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show looking at Donald Trump's threat to deport as many as 20 million immigrants living in the United States. It's a threat he repeated on an almost daily basis on the campaign trail, including at the Republican National Convention.
That's why, to keep our families safe, the Republican platform promises to launch the largest deportation operation in the history of our country. Even larger than that of President Dwight D. Eisenhower from many years ago. You know, he was a moderate, but he believed very strongly in borders. He had the largest deportation operation we've ever had.
We're joined right now by a historian who's closely studied past mass deportation programs in the United States. Ana Raquel Mignon is an associate professor of history at Stanford University and the author of In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. The recent piece for Dissent magazine is titled Trump's Deportation Model. So, Professor Mignon, if you can start off by talking about Trump's victory, what that model is, and, you know, his famous motto, make America great again, go back in history and talk about the mass deportations of people in the United States.
Thank you. In many ways, we think that Trump is a new model, a person who completely goes against the grain of American history in terms of deportations, in terms of his treatment of immigrants. But as he noted himself, that is absolutely not true. What he was referring to when he spoke about Eisenhower was an operation that occurred in 1954 titled Operation Wetback. And this was a massive deportation campaign. The tactics were military tactics. They brought tanks. They brought border patrol people all throughout the border, airplanes. People were grabbed from their houses and taken to the border, stopped outside of their jobs and taken to the border. Their families didn't know where they had been. It was a very cruel operation. In the year 1954, the year of Operation Wetback, over 1 million people were deported. And this is the model that Trump says that he is going to expand. And it comes at huge costs to America, to its communities, and to the people themselves. In the United States, when Operation Wetback happened, communities were destroyed. People were left without central members, without churchgoers, without breadwinners. Families who relied on some of the folks who were deported had to either rely on welfare or find jobs immediately. Children were left without parents. Many jobs, many employers needed workers who were deported. It was bad for the U.S. economy. It was also bad for American civil rights. Many Mexican Americans, people who were born in the United States, could be walking through the streets and considered to be Mexican just because they, quote unquote, looked Mexican, and their civil rights were not protected. Their constitutional rights were not protected. The deportation of American citizens is something that we have seen over and over again. For example, in the 1930s, there was also a massive deportation campaign against Mexicans. It occurred, of course, during the Great Depression. We estimate that from 350,000 to 1 million people were deported, and that over 60% of those were American citizens. These deportations that Trump is claiming that he will do will have mass implications to our civil rights, to our communities, and to our economy. And of course, to the people who are being deported themselves.
And if you could explain, if you could put that in the context of more recent history, in other words, how does Trump's proposal, or in fact, what his actual policies that he implemented in the 4 years he was in power from 2016 on immigration, how do they compare with what the Biden administration did and what Kamala Harris said herself, since it was also central to her, immigration, border security, was also central to her campaign?
Absolutely. In many ways, the Biden administration also led an extremely anti-immigrant movement. His administration first continued the return to Mexico policy, continued Title 42. What did these policies do? These policies meant that either asylum seekers could not even apply for asylum in the United States, even though asylum is something that we abide to because of our own international law and because of international agreements. And it said that, and the Remain in Mexico policy said that if we were to accept asylum seekers to apply for asylum, they had to wait while their cases were adjudicated in northern Mexico. While people waited in northern Mexico for either Title 42 to go away or for the Remain in Mexico policy to be allowed in, people lived in terrible encampments where they were regularly raped, tortured, mugged. It was absolutely brutal, the conditions there. In fact, I once interviewed a woman who had fostered a child during Trump's zero tolerance policy, the policy that Trump implemented that separated children from their parents while in detention. And this woman who had fostered one of these little kids who was separated from his father while crossing the border because of the Trump administration said right now, the Biden administration's remain in Mexico policy is basically a zero tolerance policy in reverse. Why? The conditions in northern Mexico were so brutal that some parents made the heart-wrenching decision of sending their children across the border because unaccompanied minors were the only ones who could get into the United States while their parents had to wait in northern Mexico. Even recently, the Biden campaign has dramatically reduced the number of asylum seekers who can come into the country. These policies have been devastating to asylum seekers and migrants. But there is, I believe, a big difference between what Trump did and what Biden did, even if not so much numerically. The rhetoric that Trump implemented, the anti-immigrant discourse, calling Mexicans animals, all Central Americans as belonging to MS-13, calling people rapists, that is not something that we heard so much from the Biden administration or from Kamala Harris's campaign. And that rhetoric matters. That rhetoric leads to violence in Latino communities, and eventually it also pushes people, administrations, to move further and further toward anti-immigrant policies. Additionally, Trump's family separation policy was explicitly created for purposes of deterrence. What does this mean? Trump implemented the zero tolerance policy to cause harm to asylum seekers in order to warn other asylum seekers not to try to come into the United States. The very purpose of this policy was to cause harm. This is different from the policies that Biden has implemented and that Kamala Harris promised to implement as well, even though they, too, would have created massive harm.
And if you could say, given all of that, especially what you said, the distinctions are between Kamala and Biden and Trump, you know, so many exit polls have found across the board there was an increase in the number of votes for Trump. And obviously, a Latinx community is a massive and highly diverse community. But among this community, however defined, there was also an increase in the number of people who voted for Trump. How do you understand that?
I do want to emphasize your first point, which is why are we even thinking of a Latinx community when we think of votes? We know, for example, that Cubans have regularly voted Republican, that Mexicans have switched back and forth. So I have been a little disturbed by this concept of a Latinx community and the blame that has been put on this community for the election of Trump nowadays. But there is a history that we must understand. For example, if we look at the Mexican-American community, right now, the biggest Latinx community is of Mexicans. And Mexicans have changed, Mexican-Americans have changed their views around migration many times. Up until the 1970s, most Mexican-Americans viewed immigrants as a huge problem. Why? When immigrants arrived in the United States, They were cast as bringing disease, bringing crime, just like nowadays. And so Mexican Americans had an option. They could, and one of these options was to say, look, we are not them. We don't want them here. If they don't come, we won't be stereotyped as criminals. We won't be stereotyped as bringing in disease. Stop them from coming. So this was a very common speech and rhetoric of the Mexican-American community up until the 1970s. This type of rhetoric began to change because of the civil rights movement. Because of the civil rights movement of the 1960s, when Mexican-Americans said, actually, these people are our brethren. We are still being discriminated. Instead of stopping their discrimination, instead of fighting for them not to come, let us say, they should not be discriminated either.
Ana Raquel Mignon, we have to leave it there, and we thank you so much for being with us. Associate Professor of History at Stanford University, author of In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Join us here on CFRC on November 11th for an afternoon and early evening in honor of Sheila Rogers, Queen's University's 16th Chancellor. Listen to the convocation ceremony in Grant Hall that will include her official installation as Chancellor starting at 2:30 p.m. and then join in the fun wherever you are in the world for the Chancellor's installation reception broadcasting live from the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts from 5:30 to 7 p.m. featuring outstanding Chancellor-curated music and engaging speakers such as the Principal of Queens, the Rector, and the Chancellor herself. We look forward to celebrating with you on November 11th. Learn more on the Queen's Chancellor installation webpage. This is our life.
Hello, Zoe Deschanel, and welcome to another episode of
Beep Banter. It never gets easier trying to do it over Zoom. My name is Aiden.
And I'm Sarah.
And today we have